Welcome, Brother Jacob, to the Conclave.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
And we're excited to have you. You can choose from any of these habitats. As you can see over here, we have the Twilight Garden.
Ooh.
Very lovely. And over here, the Vale of the Wild, if your tastes run more ferocious.
Ah. And what's that one?
Oh, that's the Mana Storm. We don't talk about the Mana Storm. Focus on the others. Focus on the Vales.
Ah, okay.
Welcome to the Mystic Vale. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Dragon's Demise, the podcast about what happens on, around, and behind the tabletop. I'm Greg B., joined today by Jacob.
Hello.
And we're going to be reviewing Mystic Vale, sort of returning to that with all of the new expansions that have come out since we talked about it last. But first, let's talk about what we've been playing, or what Jacob's been playing, because I haven't been playing anything.
Well, I have been playing a really interesting game, and I'm going to keep this as spoiler-free as I can, because this is another Legacy game.
Ooh.
It's Betrayal at the House on the Hill.
Ooh, Legacy. I say again.
So, I have really been enjoying my time with this game.
Good. So, how many sessions have you played?
Currently, we played the prologue and then two sessions afterwards.
Okay, so you're a little ways into it.
Yeah, we're a little ways into it. We've gotten, like, you know, the two generations done, and each one is, you know, about 30 years apart kind of thing. So
okay.
It's really interesting. So for the most part, it's the same game as Betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
It has that. It has some really nice clarifications for the rules.
Oh, that's nice.
Which is great, yeah.
About, like, when you can steal and when you can...
What, and how much you can do each action and that kind of stuff. So, like, you know, any action... Actions are now, like... pretty much specified by bold text.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if there's one action that says attack, you can either attack with your bare hands, attack with one weapon, or attack with another weapon. You can't use, like, weapons together. You can't do anything like that.
Okay.
It's just, you may have one attack on your turn.
Okay.
Boom. That's it. Full stop. Nothing else. You may, you know, pick up once per turn. You may, like, give once per turn. And all these kinds of things. So anything that has, like, these big bolded text, you can only do once.
Okay.
And then it also therefore clarifies things like, if you are attacked, you are then not using your weapon to defend.
Okay.
Because that is, using the weapon is an attack.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, I see. No, that's really useful clarifications.
Yeah. So it's like, there's a lot of these kinds of things about the game that they clarified. And it's really interesting because the game, like, when we first start, you have, like, almost no tiles.
Mm-hmm.
You really quickly run out of the tiles to create the house.
Okay. So, like, just the house is small?
At first, yeah, exactly. And so the house is small, and even in the prologue, there's only one tile that has an omen.
Huh.
And the way that omens work itself has just been changed a lot. So first off, they start off with just that one omen, and then there's the legacy deck that says when someone is to draw an omen... flip this card over and then read it kind of thing.
Okay, sure.
So each time you start a scenario, it'll tell you what is the trigger for the omen, whether or not it's someone having to draw it or someone having to roll a certain number or something like that. And rather than rolling all six die and seeing where you are, like, which was the original mechanic, what you're doing now is you roll one die per omen that has been out.
Mm-hmm.
And then the legacy deck so far has just been giving us a threshold that if it's over this, then this happens.
Okay. All right. That makes sense.
So it's a little bit like it's made to scale because the game really does that quite a bit. You're starting with a very small house and pretty much the first haunt that happens is the same in every single game.
Okay, so there's like a almost sort of a specific order that the quote plot follows.
Yep.
Okay, all right.
And then as you start building on, it's almost like, you know, whenever you discover, let's say, so far it's been that it's been adding a room with an omen every game.
Okay.
So, you know, there's more and more of them, more of the omens coming out and all that kind of stuff. And so you're keeping the ones from the previous game. And you're adding the new ones. So it's like, these already have some history with them because, like, you know, this is the omen from the first game. And so it's still in the house, you know, all these generations later and that kind of stuff. And so it starts adding to the lore, which is a lot of fun. And as you go, the omens pretty much, that's when you start getting the variability. Because then, like in the second game, you still only have that one omen card, so that's drawn first, and then in which room do you discover the second omen?
Okay, all right, I see.
And so then, because then you have two different places that you could discover that omen, and depending on which one you do, that's what happens.
Like, right.
You go to a certain scenario. And then, like, this all just goes together, and then we were playing a full five-player game.
Okay.
And we had one person, the roommate of the people that we were playing at their house, he was sitting in and just like observing the game because it was interesting.
Right.
And he became like the pretty much the historian. He's playing, he's doing his own little thing where like after every game, he's like this historian who's, or like this crime scene investigator who's like looking at over this house like in modern day, like or 2005, because the game technically ends in 2004.
Oh, huh.
So it's the kind of thing where it's like, yeah, he's doing that there. And like looking back at like these traces of like what happened, it's like here we see like, you know, a lot of bodies found like, you know, in this like swampy area, and like, you know, and I see one of them like holding this and this item or something like that.
Yeah, that's really fun.
And so like we've been adding that a lot, and that's been a lot of fun. And I think so far, I haven't felt like any of the haunts were impossible.
Okay, that's good.
And even though like we triggered them, some of them we triggered on the first on one person's first turn.
Mm-hmm.
So within the first round, one of the haunts triggered, boom, it happened. But I think even so, my friends would probably dispute this one with me a little bit, because the one that I'm thinking of is one that they didn't really see the way to win it, but they honestly almost did.
Okay.
It was one of those things where I was the betrayer.
I gathered.
Yeah. So I had certain goals, and I had a certain amount of life, and you know, had other powers kind of things, and they had to whittle me down.
Sure.
And they could do so through traps and that kind of stuff. And honestly, had they not rolled badly on a few things, they probably would have gotten me down. But it just, I think from their point of view, it felt like I was being a little bit overwhelming in terms of the power that was there, because I was able to like single them out and like take them out one at a time kind of thing. So in general, it was a lot more balanced, because there's a lot more control over, you know, what comes out when and that kind of stuff. And
sure,
because you're not having this entire house, so you don't really have people like going like collecting way too much more than other people.
Right.
And I think some of the really cool things that they have added to the game are, first off, events, and I think items as well, are based on where you are. So in particular, like the events, you have upper floor events, ground floor events, basement floor, basement events, and outdoor events.
Okay.
And so they actually, like, you know, they fit, because it's like, you know, outside you can draw an event that says like, oh, the fog rolled in or something like that. It's like, yeah, that makes sense outside. And
right,
not,
that wouldn't make any like, sense upstairs in the house or something.
Yeah, exactly. And so each one of these, like, you know, makes it a lot more atmospheric, a lot more controlled of an experience, I think.
Sure.
Than Betrayal normally is. And it also has some, you know, fun stuff in terms of like the items, because you draw an item and most of them have a space for you to claim it as an heirloom item.
Okay.
So you don't get to keep that between games, but whenever you get it again, you get the bonus effect that's on the bottom.
Oh,
so it like enhances the effect.
Interesting. But you don't get to keep it, though.
No, you don't. Yeah.
Huh.
So I think later on in the game, because right now the games have been jumping into the betrayal really quickly.
Okay.
It's been only like a few turns. We're still exploring. Not the entire thing has been explored. And already the betrayal is happening.
Sure.
Which I don't think is a bad thing, but it's also just like the pace is just fast forwarded almost.
Right.
It's partially also because we don't have that much of house to explore.
Yeah.
We've explored pretty much the entire house most of the times that we've been in there. And so I think later on we'll be like trading items and things like that to make sure that people have the right ones and that kind of stuff.
The, mm-hmm.
the betrayers are going to try to keep those away and that kind of thing. And it's also a lot of fun to like, you know, have the person who won the last game like be the one to like, you know, just read the ending part, and like they add certain events, certain items, certain things like start coming into the game and that kind of stuff. And then if you won the game prior, the bonus is that you start with the deed of the house.
Okay.
And what that does is once per game allows you to pretty much teleport to any discovered room.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's so pretty
it's just
good.
Like, boom, you get to go anywhere.
Right.
After the first session, it's a little bit unclear that there is a winner, almost.
Okay.
Because the victory condition is a little bit strange. It's like, yeah, you're supposed to kill the witch if you're the people, and if you're the people, or if you're the witch, you're supposed to be the last one standing, kind of thing.
Okay, sure.
But there's a twist in there that makes it so that doesn't really make that much sense.
Okay.
So it almost felt like everybody lost that scenario for me. So I didn't go to the winning speech.
Right.
And so that, like, after we won the next game, it was like, wait a minute, what is this card that they're talking about? Like, the deed card, the house deed? What is this?
Right.
And then it was like, looking back, it's like, oh, that was from the winning, like, thing that we were supposed to add from the first game.
Gotcha. So a little bit, like, confusing there.
Yeah, I think it may have just been the way that we were interpreting it or something like that. Or, like, we just weren't totally getting it, something along those lines. So might not happen to everyone, but that was one of the things that, like, I noticed.
Sure.
Otherwise, like, the game itself has been great. Like, you know, we've been starting telling stories about our families and, like, that kind of stuff. Caitlin, who's been on the stream before, mm-hmm. was playing with us, and her family is now agoraphobic and racist against the Irish.
Okay.
For different reasons.
That sounds bad.
Her family, two of her family members died outside in the, like, almost the same spots.
Ah.
And like, the other one is about, we have one of the other families being Irish, and they convinced her to not do something that would have won us the game.
Sure.
And so, yeah, it was one of those things.
Gotcha.
And so she's just like, now never going to trust the Irish again.
Right. So it's sort of just like a fun emergent narrative type thing. So.
Pretty much.
Very cool. Yeah, no, it sounds really interesting. I'd love to play it at some point.
I think that it would be a lot of fun. I think that I will probably get that. Maybe we'll stream it around Halloween.
Oh, yeah, totally.
So I think that we'll probably do something like that, because I think that it would be a great game for that.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll be done with Seafall by then.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that sounds really fun.
Yeah. Well, there you have it. That's a look at what I've been playing. All right, now let's jump into the meat of the episode. We will be talking about, well, something a little bit more vegetarian, Mystic Veil.
Hey!
So we did an episode of Mystic Veil way back when. I think it was the fourth episode that we ever had you on, including
something like that.
Before we had some of the segments that we talk about nowadays.
Yeah.
So we thought that since there have been 5 expansions, and each of them changed, like, Mystic Veil in a decently significant way,
mm-hmm.
we would do a bit of a re-review and focus on these expansions, because I think that it since our first review has changed my opinion at least a little bit in terms of Mystic Veil. So first of all, let's do a quick overview of how Mystic Veil is played.
Exactly. So Mystic Veil, at its core, is a deck builder. You are acquiring new cards to put into your deck in order to power it up so that you can buy more powerful things and so on and so forth until someone has the most victory points and they win. The twist here is that instead of acquiring cards to put in your deck, you're acquiring advancements, which are little plastic sheets that slot into one of 3 slots, either top, middle, or bottom, on the cards that are already in your deck. This is done using sort of the special card crafting system, which is pretty unique, at least to my knowledge, among deck builders.
Oh yeah, for sure. And throughout the game, you have this 20-card deck that you're just building up. You're getting points. You are also buying veils, which are these separate cards. They are permanent, like, effects, pretty much. They could be just points at the end of the game. They could actually give you an in-game effect. And they're bought using one of the 2 types of currency in the game. You've got your regular mana, and then you've got your spirit symbols.
Right.
The regular mana is used for the advancements. The spirit symbols are used for the veils. You keep buying cards like this until you play through the game, and all the victory chits that you have allotted for this game run out.
Right.
Now, one of the main things about Mystic Veil is how the cards come out onto the field. So most deck builders, you know, draw cards into your hand. That's not how Mystic Veil works. What happens is you put cards out into your field. And the way that you do that is you, you know, draw from your deck, put it out, and you stop when you have three of these symbols called decay symbols showing. You have one card on deck, which is technically not part of your field, and then the rest of your cards out in your field. This happens normally at the end of your turn, and then at the beginning of your next turn, you have the chance to push. This means that you can take the card that is on deck and put it out into your field so it can be used. This, however, means that you have a new on-deck card, and if that one shows at least one other decay, you will then spoil. So if you have four decay showing at any time without any other special effects that cancel it out, you will spoil, your turn is over, you discard your pretty much anything that's on field, and next person goes, you start to push through your deck again.
Right. So overall, Mystic Veil, you've got these sort of combination of unique mechanics, the card crafting mechanic, the press your luck element almost, and sort of the playing from your field rather than from your hand. And all of that comes together to make the game. As Jacob mentioned, the game will continue until you run out of victory point chits, which are the number of those that you have is determined by the number of players. And when you take them is determined by some of the advancements that you can buy. So you can, if you want to prolong the game, you can do that. Or if you want to rush towards the end of the game, you can sort of purchase cards that are going to get you towards that end game state. But there are other sources of points as well. Veils, we mentioned, have some points on them. Many advancements, though not all, have points on them. And all three of those are going to combine together to give you your point total at the end of the game.
And then whoever has the most points wins. What a shocker.
Right? Yeah, this isn't golf. It is most points wins. And that is the core of Mystic Veil. So we mentioned five new expansions that have come out since then, and each of them has added something pretty substantial to the game. So the first of these, chronologically, was the Veil of Magic, which didn't actually add any new mechanics. They just increased the number of cards. I think about 50% more veils, more advancements at each tier.
Yeah.
Oh, that was one other thing, is that there are three different levels of advancements. So you've got level one, which are relatively cheap and not terribly impactful, all the way up to level three, which are like huge, monstrous, game-changingly powerful cards.
Yeah. The next one that came out is Veil of the Wild. Now, Veil of the Wild is, I think, one of the most significant expansions.
Yeah.
Because it added at least these two mechanics, which are the leaders. These are full-size cards that give you like a special powerful ability. They're double-sided. You can flip them at different times that will give you even more powerful abilities and just like let you do a lot more. The leaders have very powerful abilities and can almost shape how you play the game. They give you bonuses to purchasing, bonuses to interacting with cards, doing other things. They just have really cool abilities.
Right.
The other thing that was added by the Veil of the Wild is the Eclipse symbol. Now, these are cards that you can pretty much sleeve under other cards or have cards that go on top of them, advancements that go on top of them, that actually cover most of them up, which is not something you can do with any other cards in the game.
Right.
The last thing that the Veil of the Wild adds is almost a new focus for the game, whereas in the base game, the focus is really on canceling out a lot of the decay. Veil of the Wild really adds incentives to collect more decay and makes that into almost a resource rather than just a detriment.
Right. Next up on the expansions was Mana Storm. In Mana Storm, there were two new, well, one new mechanic and one new sort of element introduced. The new mechanic are Evoke tokens. So by default, everybody has a token that they can flip that gains them one mana, and they don't get it back until they spoil. Mana Storm introduced new variant versions of this, so their abilities tend to be more powerful. You can get multiple mana, you can get spirit symbols instead, you can get extra purchases, so these can be really big things, but they tend to come with the other element that Mana Storm added, which is negative points. So there are some advancements now. Some of these Evoke tokens actually give you negative points at the end of the game. That was introduced in Mana Storm as a balancing element, as the designers sort of continued to try to tweak how the game was balanced.
The next expansion is, I guess, the biggest expansion, at least physically.
Literally.
It is the Conclave expansion, and this one, first of all, gave you a giant box to hold all of Mystic Vale.
Giant box. We're talking, we have everything in that box, and it's still only like one third full.
Yeah. So this, I think, shows that the game is going to be big at some point. But it also actually added some really cool other elements. Mostly, first of all, two extra players.
Yes.
It Love takes it. The game from a four-player game max to a six-player game max. With that came one other thing, which is a little bit of a different way to play, which is called the Equinox variant. And this pretty much speeds up play for a six-player game, because if you were just sitting around waiting for your turn on a six-player game, it would take a little bit too long.
Yeah.
And also, there are the totems. Now, the totems are these really powerful cards. They are continuous effects, pretty much, that you can use on each one of your turns that just do some crazy shit, honestly. It can be anything from, like, giving you at least one mana per turn to, you know, having three different effects that you can use that, like, will work together to give you a certain amount of mana, bonuses, points, something. It's just extremely powerful. And they're a lot of fun to play with.
Yeah, I think totems are very powerful. They really move in the direction of, I've heard people refer to something called Battlecruiser magic. We're talking really big, powerful, stompy cards. This is Mystic Vale's equivalent of that.
Mm-hmm. And the last thing that it added were the actual titular conclaves. So this is where you, instead of using everything that you have in Mystic Vale, you take out different advancements to have like a more tailored game that really, like, you know, you can focus on one thing or another thing, and it helps with the overload of cards almost.
Right. These are pretty comparable to in other deck builder games where you'll have like a recommended setup.
Yeah.
Where it says these are the cards that you should put in the commons.
Exactly.
And then finally, the newest expansion is called Twilight Garden. And Twilight Garden introduces curse tokens, which are sort of a natural outgrowth of negative points on cards. Mm-hmm. So with curse tokens, basically, instead of taking victory points, you take curse tokens, which are worth negative victory points. So again, this is a balancing mechanic. A lot of times you'll have really powerful card effects on an otherwise very cheap card, but the penalty is once per turn, while that card is in play, you have to take negative points. So that's how they sort of balance that. The other thing that Twilight Garden seems to introduce is actually some elements of player interaction.
Yeah.
So where before you pretty much had your 20 cards and that was it, you were really just staying in your lane, optimizing with limited interaction where you could like use the abilities on the cards of players to your left or right, but for the most part, it was just your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Twilight Garden actually now introduces abilities that allow you to take a card from your own deck and put it in someone else's deck if it's got curses on it or is negative points. You've got cards that allow you to steal cards from other players' decks. So you're seeing a lot more interaction between players in this expansion, which I think is really interesting.
Oh yeah, for sure. So these are the five expansions that have come out for Mystic Vale. Let's talk a little bit about, like, just in general, how they change the game.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that comes to mind first for me is power scaling.
Yeah.
So I think the first time we ever played with Vale of the Wild, you and I looked at each other, we looked at our point totals, and we said, holy shit.
Yep.
You know, because we had just played with leaders for the first time, and we were looking at point totals were easily double what we had previously acquired, because you've got these very, very powerful, almost anchor cards that really help direct your strategy, and if you build to them, they have a multiplication effect.
Yeah, they magnify what you can do depending on which one it is, and they can really have some extremely powerful and extremely cool effects.
And I think totems are another sort of version of that, where you've got these, again, extremely powerful cards that are going to amplify whatever strategy you choose to play for. And if you end up with a leader and a totem that are synergistic, well, then no one's getting in your way.
Exactly. Except for other people who have a leader and a totem who are synergistic.
Exactly, exactly.
Because that's, I think, one of the good things that they did is I don't think that any of the leaders are really too underpowered.
Yeah, I think for the most part, all of the sort of periphery elements, mm-hmm. the leaders, even the evoke tokens, the totems, all are very equivalent.
Yeah, and I think like they've definitely tried to do that because, I mean, a lot of the leaders, like especially the most powerful ones, they have like huge negative point totals.
Right. Yeah. If you're unlucky enough to end them on the wrong side.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There's a lot of them actually tend to be sort of risky. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to end the game on your terms. Otherwise, you're going to get minus 40 points or something.
Exactly. Exactly. So it can be really interesting to try to balance those, because it's like sometimes you might not even want to have that leader come out because it flips during the discard phase and you're like, oh my God, like, you know, the game's going to end soon.
Please.
So it's just like you can use one of your cards, like where normally you would never like skip your leader. It's like you have this one card, it's like look at the top card of your deck or whatever and discard it. And it's like, oh, thank God it was my leader. Discard that. And you know, do something like that and like cycle it through. It adds a little bit of an extra layer, I think, in there to like really just think about, like, you know, what are you going to do? How are you going to plan this? What are the people around you doing? That kind of stuff.
I think another thing that the expansions sort of move towards is shifting the game state. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you look at the game, especially as it comes in the base box, and you've really got some power spikes. You know, you've got some cards that are maybe not objectively better, but whenever they come up, everybody's eyes light up because they're great. They're just universally good. And so they fit into any given strategy. And with the expansions, there seems like there has been a really conscious effort on the part of the design team to respond to those strategies and those cards and say, okay, we want to actually keep, you know, quote, the meta fresh. You know, we want to introduce cards that allow you to pursue new strategies or allow you to pursue sort of a previously inaccessible version of a different strategy. Mm-hmm. So that has been really refreshing, I think, to see just that level of investment from the designers of the game, that they've managed to keep it interesting rather than just doubling down on the same old mechanics.
Exactly. The new cards aren't just, you know, reskins of the old cards. No, there are some significantly different mechanics in there. Mm-hmm. You know, everything from just how they interact with other cards, the fact that they have like some of these symbols, like the guardian symbols on the cards, and they're able to use them in a lot of different ways. And I think that that helps a lot. I think one of the major differences, and this is what came up with Conclave, is the six player variant.
Yeah.
And the six player variant, honestly, I am so happy that it exists.
Yeah.
I love Mystic Veil. I think that adding the six players and the way that they did it was just done really well. I like that you have this Eclipse variant, pretty much. And what that means is that you have two sides of the board, the day side and the night side. And two people across from each other have the tokens. One has the day, one has the night. And then these get passed as we go. And so you're never really waiting more than three turns to take a turn.
Right. And the other part of this is that they're completely mirrored. So you have a day commons with certain advancements and certain veils, and you have a night commons. And so you can't just be thinking about, oh, this is what I want to get. You have to be thinking about, oh, wait, am I taking a day turn or a night turn next?
Yeah.
That means I am going to have, you know, oh, I'm going to be only limited to these pools of things. So you have to almost respond much more creatively rather than just looking at a single pool and saying, okay, this is what I want to do.
Yeah, and I think that actually, you know, helps with a major problem that I have with a lot of deck builders, which is that, you know, you have your static cards that you can't refresh anything. And being able to have these two commons really, really helps with that, because instead of having just three level one advancements out, you now have six.
Right.
And same with level two, the level three.
One of the other elements I think that this sort of this combination of expansions has done is that it's taken the game and it's sort of upped what was already a decently steep learning curve.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of unique things going on in this game. You've got, you know, a unique press your luck system during the play phase. You've got unique ways to literally construct your cards. You've got all these sorts of combinations of relatively uncommon game elements that have just been, you know, okay, we're going to add this, and then we're going to add this, and then we're going to add that. So one thing I do want to say before we get to No Game is Perfect, because I think that this isn't a knock, it's just an observation, is that there is a learning curve to the game. And I think there's definitely almost a graduated way to introduce people to the game. You know, you want to say, okay, well, here's just the base game. Let's get you caught up on these concepts, and then say, okay, well, now here's leaders, and now here's totems. And so I personally have benefited from learning the game that way over a number of years, rather than having the whole thing thrown in my face all at once. So
not that we haven't done that to our friends.
Literally last week.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so if you are interested, you know, if you have the game and you're interested in teaching it, or if you're interested in acquiring the game with multiple expansions at once, that just do be aware of that.
Yeah, for sure. I think that one of the things about the learning curve is just that it also encompasses the fact that, like, you know, this is not a traditional deck builder, so you almost have to switch your thinking a little bit from the traditional deck builder thinking of, like, you know, how many cards are coming out and all that kind of stuff, that type of thing. It takes a moment for even, like, veteran players to do that if they haven't played Mystic Veil before, but it's one of those games where it's worth it.
Yeah, totally agree.
But as we're wont to say, no game is perfect.
Right, not even this one. And as the person who typically sets up and puts away the games, organization with this one is a disaster. So you've got so many advancements and so many veils and so many... The leaders in totems are less of an issue because there's just fewer of them. But with the veils and the advancements, there's no expansion symbols or icons anywhere on those cards. There's no clear indicator. Even in the Conclave box, there's not really an obvious storage solution.
Yeah.
So apart from cross-referencing the name of every single advancement with the index in the back of each rulebook, there's literally no way to organize it all by set, by expansion. So if you wanted to play with just the base game and Veil of the Wild, that would be like a Herculean task just to set that up.
Yeah.
This is a game that is sort of desperately in need of just that one extra little, even just a little expansion symbol in the corner of each advancement, I think would go a long way towards being able to visually say, okay, bam, and sort that out.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, even just having enough separators, because, I mean, Conclave did come with separators for them and all that kind of stuff. But if they had a separator for each type of card.
Right.
With, like, you can put it on there or something like that and just have it, like, separated, boom, 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 like that, similar to what Dominion does.
Mm-hmm.
So something like that would definitely make sense, would definitely work well. But along with that, I think one of the things that really necessitates that is the fact that the game itself, when you're playing and you don't separate anything out, it becomes very overwhelming.
It's so much.
Like, there are just so many of these different cards that I think Conclave added the Conclaves themselves, which are great in terms of, like, the idea of, like, you know, having them there and being able to sort the game and having those recommended decks. But if you're not playing with those, or if you're playing with every expansion and not caring about that and don't want to sort it out or anything like that, it is a lot. You might not get any of the cards that you want. You might not see anything that you want. You might get to see the card that you were like, oh, this would be perfect if only, like, the middle one or the bottom one comes out, and that one is on the very bottom of the deck.
Yeah.
So it makes it a lot more difficult to get through the cards and find similar ones, find the typesets that you want and things like that.
Right. And this is sort of compounded by the fact that in a given game, it can be difficult to access the higher levels of card. Mm-hmm. You know, the just sort of the way the game naturally progresses, you've got sort of a mana scaling mechanic. You know, in the early turns, you buy the level one cards, and then it seems like you're expected to, in the mid game, buy the level twos, and in the late game, buy the level threes. And that's not always a possibility, just because of how long it takes to acquire the resources, the just sheer amount of mana to acquire the level threes. And if you're not getting the level threes that anybody wants, those cards are just going to sit out there because there's not a refresh mechanic. Everybody's going to buy through the level twos, and then, I mean, that's fine, that's going to up your deck, but it's not going to be the same really satisfying, impactful, like, ha-ha-ha-ha type of moment. So that's something that I think, I don't know exactly what the solution would be there. Maybe a refresh mechanic. Maybe, you know, we mentioned the Equinox variant. Mm-hmm. I do think having a separate commons goes a long way, because even though they're separate, they do pull from the same deck.
Yeah.
So you're still getting through the same deck, just from different sources. So
I also think that the totems really help with that.
It's true. They increase your power level to the point where it does become possible to acquire the level threes, you know, reasonably often.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, it can just be, it can be tough, especially if you're playing with a limited number of expansions, or especially just the base game, to get to the level 3 advancements.
Exactly, exactly. That all being said, let's go ahead and dive into what we think of the game as a whole. So we do this whole rating system on a scale of buy it, play it, skip it. So buy it is our highest normal rating, and skip it is our lowest. We also have top shelf and burn it ratings. Burn it we have not used. Top shelf, we have a few of them. So, Greg, what do you think?
Buy it.
Yep.
I mean, so you bought every expansion.
Yes.
But I actually did buy the base game. I do own the base Mystic Veil game, and I think it's fantastic. I've always had a fondness for deck builders. I came up on Dominion. That was sort of one of my introductions to hobby games. And I think this is one of the best of the bunch. It's so unique. The theme is delightful. The art is fantastic. The mechanics are outstanding. I think you put all of that together and you've got a game that is just an absolute winner. Everyone that I've ever played with has really enjoyed it. Might have taken them a game or two to get used to how it works, but they loved it. So it's definitely a buy it for me.
All right. So now I'm going to put you on the spot. Name the top two expansions that if you could only have two expansions, which two would it be?
If I could only have two expansions. Okay. Definitely Veil of the Wild. I think that the leaders, just the introduction of leaders, did so much to change the game, as well as sort of shifting up the strategies that are available. And then I'm going to go with Conclave. The ability to add a fifth and sixth player is fantastic. You know, the totems, I like them. I could also play games that I'm perfectly satisfied without them. But really, the Equinox variant is, I think, the shining star of the Conclave expansion.
All right. So now my turn. I'm going to go ahead and actually elevate this even above the buy it. For me, Mystic Veil is a top shelf game. This is a game that I absolutely love. I don't think that I see almost any situation in which I will say no to playing this game. And any expansion that comes out for it, I will most likely buy on site. Like, if I see it in stores, it is coming home with me. And so I love it. I think that it's just one of my favorite games total. It's, first of all, it's about druids. If you know me.
That is a pet passion of yours.
So yeah, there's that. Then like the artwork is amazing. The themes are amazing. I love the card crafting. The fact that you are pretty much just building your cards and you can count the cards easily. I don't have to worry about, you know, thinking how much is left of my deck. I don't have to do any of this kind of stuff. It's just like, okay, I have this many in my discard pile, this many on hand, and have this many cards left in my deck. All right, I know the general probability that something will come out. All in all, it is one of my favorite games in my entire collection. Now, I'm also going to answer the question that I asked Greg. Which two expansions would I get? Easily, Veil of the Wild and Conclave.
Bam, unanimous.
So those are the two that I think add the most and the best elements of the game. Like, leaders, absolutely. I wouldn't really like to play the game without them, almost. I think that for me, they just add so much, and they're so interesting that they're almost a necessity. And then the Equinox variant, the six-player variant, all those things. And I actually really do love the totems. So all those things in Conclave, I definitely think that that's where it's at.
So there you go. That's our thoughts on Mystic Veil plus all of its many expansions. Hopefully there's more to come. As always, as we head out, we're going to leave you with our thoughts about what games you might like if you like Mystic Veil and vice versa. Deck builders, you know, we've said it over and over again, but, you know, choose your flavor, right? Dominion, Ascension, Trains. If you like the elements of deck building, the elements that are important there, building an engine, advancing, getting better cards, trying to beat out your opponent by being the best you can be, Mystic Veil is great. If you like those games, definitely check it out, and vice versa.
Exactly. And there you have it. That's our review of Mystic Veil. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Dragon's Demise. We hope that you enjoyed it. If you like Mystic Veil and have a friend who likes deck builders, be sure to tag them in the comments of this week's post on Facebook and ask them what they think. It's a great game and we'd love to share it with as many people as we can. Also, thank you to all of our Patreon supporters who help make this possible. In particular, let's thank you to our Greater Worm patrons, who are Meg, Carissa, Sam, Hunter, and Casey. Thank you for all the support, and we really, really appreciate it. This week, we are streaming Near and Far on Wednesday, so be sure to join us on twitch.tv/dragonsdemise there, as well as joining us on Friday for when we will be playing some Gloomhaven, God's willing anyway. And finally, be sure to join us next Monday for another episode of Dragon's Demise.